Blog Talk Radio.
Readers Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Welcome to Readers Entertainment Radio, tonight's segment, Behind the Mask. I'm your host, Ed English, and our guest tonight is comic writer, slash photographer, slash bass player, Dan Wickline. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Well, thank you, Ed.
So, I knew that you had written comics, because we've been friends for a couple of years, but I was actually caught my attention when I saw that you are the writer of the new Shadowhawk series from Image. Tell us a little bit about that.
I had done some previous work with Jim Valentino with a couple different series, including a title called Savage that I had done with Steve Niles. And we had run into each other at a convention in Arizona about a year or so back, and he had started talking about Shadowhawk and how he was looking to bring back the original character. And I threw out a man, you know, hey, I always loved the character, and, you know, it'd be great to see him back. And he asked if I had any ideas on how to bring him back, being that the character was dead. And I said, well, let me see if I can come up with anything, and I'll let you know. And, you know, I think a couple other writers were in, you know, in the lottery for it as well. And I pitched a particular approach that he liked, and he gave me the job. So, you know, I got a buddy of mine named Tone Rodriguez is doing the art on it, and we're two issues into it now. The first story arc is five issues called Resurrection, and it tells how the original Shadowhawk, a gentleman named Paul Johnstone, comes back to life, and how different it is now that he's been dead 15 years.
Well, I've had the privilege to read the first two issues, and I must say I'm greatly impressed both with the story and the artwork. But this is your first true superhero book, is that correct?
Yes.
I guess, you know, you've been writing for quite some time. What kept you out of that? Just opportunity or personal preference, or what was up with that?
Mainly opportunity. When I first started writing, I got a lot of breaks because of a friend of mine, again, named Steve Niles, and that led me down a path of doing a lot of horror writing, which I enjoy doing immensely, but, you know, originally I got into comics wanting to do superheroes. So, you know, I was eager when an opportunity finally came along to write a true superhero, and, you know, I'm having an absolute blast doing it.
So, if you got into comics for superheroes, what were your early favorites?
The first book I ever got a hold of was a Captain America issue, which my uncle bought me when I was like five. And I read mainly Marvel growing up, though I'm probably more of a DC fan right now than I am Marvel. But I grew up reading Daredevil and Spider-Man and, you know, X-Men, and probably Daredevil was my favorite. Just the whole, you know, swinging and acrobatics, and, you know, he just came across to me as a true superhero. But I didn't make the jump to wanting to write comics until I was about 11, and I went to a convention at the Biltmore Hotel in Los Angeles, where I got a chance to meet Jack Kirby.
Awesome.
Yeah, he was. The thing was that he was there for a very short time, and I had run up there with a Captain America comic that I had bought at the show, and he signed it for me, and I was like, you know, just so impressed by this guy and so wowed by meeting my first comic creator that I ran around the con buying the entire Black Panther run that he did and got them all, had to borrow money from my friends to get all of them. And when I turned back, he was done. He was gone. But a friend of mine saw him going up the escalator towards the exit, and I raced after him and caught him in the lobby. So Mr. Kirby was done with the show, going home, yet he stopped and signed all 15 comics for me in the lobby of the Biltmore Hotel, and I remember just thinking, you know, comic book people are the greatest people in the world, and I want to work in this industry.
Well, I definitely agree with you there. That's just an incredible story. So then you said that you were 11,
mm-hmm.
and then when did you first then start putting pen to paper to try to craft some stories?
Well, I was foolishly enough believing I was an artist when I was younger, and that lasted till just about the end of high school, and I realized I couldn't draw to save my life. So I started writing then. I also did a lot of theater work in high school, and I realized that writing a comic script and writing a play were very similar. You know, the only difference being that you describe what you want to see in the panel, but the dialoguing and stuff like that, it's all pretty similar. So I started, I think I wrote my first true comic script senior year of high school, hooked up with a group of artists a couple years later that wanted to get started and published my first comic in 96, which was called Creepers, and sold about 7 copies.
Well, that's a good start.
I still have some in my garage, by the way, if anybody's interested.
And that was in 96, so that was your first published one.
Yes.
Okay, well, I noticed that you also did the letters and coloring on that issue. Was that just a carryover from your artwork days, or was that something that you did by necessity because of limited resources? Or
It was mainly because of necessity. You know, when you're putting together, you know, it's like putting on a play in your dad's barn. You scramble to do anything you need, and it came down to everybody wanted to write, draw, or ink, and nobody wanted to color or letter. So I got a hold of a computer and learned how to do it, and ended up just doing it myself, just to get the book out.
And so that's kind of, so it was kind of self-published, or?
Yeah. I mean, I created a company called Hardline Studios, and we published the one book in 96, and then published 3 more books in 99 and 2000. And that's when I realized I really didn't want to be a publisher. I wanted to be just a writer.
But I guess that's a good learning experience.
It is. I mean, I have a unique background now that I have dealt with Diamond. I have dealt with retailers. I can put an entire comic book together. And in those years, not only did I write color and letter, I also inked some pages, did the layouts on pages, drew in some background characters. I mean, I've done just about everything except for draw, you know, the main pages.
Now, I noticed from some of your early works that, you know, you had some assistants, you know, guys like Lee Trotter, Steve Ellis, Jeff Crumpler. Were those just guys that you knew who had a similar interest, or were you able to hook up with those guys to complete your work?
It was interesting. There's a lot of people that want to do comics, so you find other people of the like mind at comic shops or conventions and stuff like that. And these were just people that I found. You know, I met Crumpler, for instance. I met him through a gentleman named Jason Jewett, who was friends of an inker named Joe Weems, who, you know, Joe's done a lot of stuff for Marvel, DC, Top Cow, and Harris. And I met Joe at a convention, and Joe introduced me to Jason, and then Jason ended up introducing me to Crumpler, and, you know, we ended up working together on something because we both wanted to get into comics.
Wow. That's cool. Now, being in California, you probably have had plenty of opportunity to go to comic conventions.
Oh, more than my fair share.
Unfortunately, I have yet to attend one in my 39 years of existence. I guess living in Ohio and Kentucky doesn't lend itself well to to that. But what was your first? Was meeting Jack Kirby your first Comic-Con experience?
Yes, that was the first one, and then I didn't go to another one until 94, so you know, I was 24 years old by then.
Oh, well, was it just, you know, obviously at 11 you had to figure out a way to make that happen, but was it just a matter of funding up until the age of 24 to be able to get there?
I didn't really know that much about the industry at that point. There's never really been a lot of conventions in L.A. It's a horrible place to have a convention because you can't, I mean, there's no, anywhere you go downtown, there's no parking, you know, it's always expensive. So, you know, L.A. is a horrible place to have an actual convention. And there was no way I was heading down to San Diego for Comic-Con. I didn't even know really what Comic-Con was at that point. So it wasn't until I hooked up with a gentleman who was putting a show together at the Pomona Fairgrounds that I went to my second Comic-Con, and I actually went with the first couple books for Hardline as Ashcans. So we were out there. Yeah, so I, you know, my second con, I went as a writer, not as a fan.
Now I see that you've got about a dozen or so books that you've put out, probably closer to 15, that you've written prior to hooking up with IDW and getting in on the 30 Days of Night franchise. Tell us, how did that come about?
30 Days of Night was I was running a website called Comic World News, and it was basically a place for me to interview. You know, like you're interviewing me, I was interviewing different comic professionals and stuff like that. And in a way, I was also trying to build my name to, you know, get it out there more. And one of the people I had interviewed was Steve Niles. And this was actually about 6 or 7 months before the first 30 Days of Night comic had ever come out.
Mm-hmm.
This was when he was promoting a book called Fused. And we hit it off, and then it turned out he was we did a phone interview, but, you know, we had a good chat while we were interviewing. And then about 2 weeks later, he was doing a signing at a local comic shop. So I swung by there to, you know, meet him in person. And we became friends over the years. And as it progressed, I did two things with IDW pretty close together. Besides becoming friends with Steve, through Steve, I also became friends with Ben Templesmith, who was the original artist on the 30 Days of Night series. And Ben, living in Australia, we would talk through Instant Messenger, and I would talk to Steve through Instant Messenger. And it turned out one day both of them were looking for something new to do, and Ben was tired of drawing vampires, so he wanted me to do a story about guys in suits with samurai swords. And that was literally all he cared about, was guys in suits with samurai swords.
Okay.
So I wrote a book called Bloodstained Sword, and it was just a 48-page one-shot, and he got IDW to pick that up. And at the same time, I started talking to Steve about a vampire autopsy and and we would do this a lot. We would just, you know, theorize back and forth on different things, and we just happened to be talking about a vampire autopsy and what body parts a vampire wouldn't need if to survive. And I said, well, maybe not lungs, because, you know, they can survive underground. And he said, yeah, that's probably right. They could probably go without their lungs. I said, yeah, they'd be great astronauts. Well, that led to about a half dozen different jokes back and forth about vampire astronauts. At least I thought they were jokes. And then he says, well, I got Milks to draw this series for us. And I'm like, what series? He says, it's one where we're going to put the vampires in space. I'm like, what? And sure enough, we took the outline of the chat conversation we had, because we kept going for a while on this riff, and turned that into what eventually became Dead Space.
And that was a 3-issue series?
Yeah. Though Steve originally wanted to call it Suckernaut.
But then you went on to do a couple other of the 30 Days of Night series as well.
Well,
After that.
I did one called Spreading the Disease. What was funny was we got a lot of feedback on Dead Space, and the main question was, well, why would anybody want to put a vampire in space? And I thought, well, yeah, this is kind of an important question. So I played with that in my head for a while, and I came up with a reason. And I went to Steve, and I said, okay, if we can get this in, here's an idea for a follow-up miniseries. And I pitched it to him. He says, well, I like the idea, but I have no time to do it. I thought, oh, great, well, it's kind of dead there. He goes, so just write it on your own.
There you go.
Okay. So I got to do a 5-part series, and the editor on the project was a buddy of mine named Dan Taylor. And I had a lot of fun with Dan because each issue I try to up the ante a little bit, and I'd say, okay, I'm gonna kill an entire wedding party with Locust in this one. They're never going to accept that. And Dan would come back going, all right, go for it. Like, oh, well, okay, I'm going to kill an entire bar full of people with beer. And, you know, the gene is in the beer, and he approved that. So finally on the 5th issue, I said, I'm going to blow up the Super Bowl. And the only note I got back from him was, I have no problem with you blowing up the Super Bowl, but I can't accept you having Carolina and Denver in the Super Bowl.
you got to draw the line someplace.
Yeah.
So all of that, the work, that's, you know, 8 issues there. You also were able to, how did it come about that you were asked to work on the source book for that whole series?
That was also Dan. He got a hold of me about the time the movie was coming out, and what they wanted to do was have the source book to come out around the time of the movie. So if people wanted to jump into the comics after they saw the movie, they'd have this reference type thing. And a lot of companies do source books, like Marvel has the Marvel Universe and
mm-hmm.
DC has the Who's Who. But they're pretty much just like dictionary pages. You open it up, it's like, oh, there's a picture of Superman, there's his origin, there's his real name, that's how tall he is, and that's his powers. Okay, next. And I didn't really want to approach it from that. So I said, all right, I'll do it, but what I want to do is make it look like it's a collection of FBI reports or, you know, the reports from the show. You know. So I'd go through each miniseries, and I'd pick a character in it, and I'd say, okay, well, from that character's point of view, let's see how he'd write this up. And, you know, they liked that idea, and they let me run with it. And my wife actually got writing credit on that as well, because there was a couple novels in it that they wanted to include, but the deadline was so short, and there was no way I was going to be able to sit down and read the novels, where my wife is a voracious reader and can go through 500 pages in like half a day. So I said,
my wife's the same way.
Yeah. So I said, okay, you get to do the novels and summarize them up, and then we work together on those particular parts of it. And so she got her her first writing credit that way.
Well, that's kind of cool, being able to do something together like that.
Well, yeah, it was a lot of fun. Plus, the first time she ever had to sign an autograph on it was really amazing to her.
Now, did you guys do a signing at an event, or did you just sign some copies for promotion purposes or whatever?
There's a horror bookstore out here called Dark Delicacies that I'm really good friends with, and when I have a horror book come out, I go over there and do a signing, and we were at one of those, and somebody brought up the source book, and Debbie was standing next to me. I'm like, you too.
There you go.
Yeah.
Awesome. Have you always been into horror? I mean, you talked about wanting to get into comics for superhero, to do superheroes, but yet, you know, a lot of your early work was horror related.
And I'm still continuing that with horror, but oddly enough, no. I was never into horror growing up. I liked the Universal monsters. I liked the old Hammer films, but really didn't like anything newer than that. You know, I didn't get into the Freddy's and Jason's and House on Haunted Hills and, you know, or Texas Chainsaw Massacres. And even to this day, I really don't watch horror. I don't read horror. But my wife does. So usually what happens is I come up with an idea for a story, and then I come downstairs and I go, honey, has anybody done this before? And she reads it over, and it's like, no, or... well, it's similar to this, but you've got this different, that different, that different. You're good.
So did you vet the vampires in space, you know, vampire astronauts, you know, by her first?
I did. Not only that, but she's the one that came up with the title Dead Space.
Oh, cool.
Because I finally convinced Steve we're not going to call it Suckernaut, and he was okay, you know, finally agreed to give that up, but we couldn't come up with another name. And I was laying in bed, just tossing and turning, trying to come up with a name, and she rolled over. She said, just call it Dead Space and go to sleep.
Okay, done.
Yep.
Now, you did another work kind of with Steve called Strange Cases. That was you did like 4 books in that. Tell us about that.
Strange Cases was a very interesting project. It was a video game idea that Steve had come up with and did some, you know, he wrote up levels for involving a company called D2C Games. And a gentleman named Luden Lee and Scott Orr. And Scott Orr is famous for his time at EA Games, where he got some guy named John Madden to come over. Yeah. Well, this was a company Scott had started up. And they were going to do a video game based on this concept Steve had come up with called Strange Cases. And he and I, you know, bounced some ideas back and forth on it. And he said, well, you know, we ought to do a comic version of this to get people interested in it. I said, okay. Well, at the time, Warren Ellis had just come out with Fell, and he was using the 16-page format with every issue being self-contained. And I thought, hey, that'd be a fun way to go about this, where each issue you can just pick up and read, and it would be self-contained. And the whole idea of Strange Cases was about your stereotypical monster hunters, you know, your Buffy type, your Ash type, your Kolchak type, and throwing them in a city that had just about every geological climate you could think of. So you'd have, you know, Yetis, and you'd have zombies, and you'd have creatures from the Black Lagoon, you know, that type of thing. You know, whatever type of monster you wanted to play with, you'd have access to. You know, and I got, you know, and Steve's like, well, you know, again, why don't you write it? And we got an artist named David Hartman, who is one of the nicest, most laid-back guys you'll ever meet. His day job is he works on the Winnie the Pooh cartoon.
Oh, man.
And then at night, he just flies his freak flag. You know, he did the Rob Zombie animated videos for American Witch and one other song. He's just this twisted artist, and we got him to, he and his wife did all the colors, but he did all the other artwork on it, and did a 4-issue series that was just so much fun to do that, you know, I constantly have people come up to me at conventions asking if we're going to get around to doing more.
And the answer is?
I wish we could, and it really comes down to the contract that Steve has with the video game company, which
okay.
I don't know if they even exist anymore, so it's like, but if
okay.
you all pelt Steve Niles, Steve at steveniles.com.
more strange cases, please.
Yeah, I will be happy to write them. They're fun characters. And, I mean, the whole creative process was I'd call up Dave and I'd say, hey, I'm going to do a story with this character. What monsters do you want to draw this time? And he'd come back and say, I want to draw Yetis. Okay, we're going to have a snow issue. And then I'd write the story.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Now, you and I were talking before the show about several of the anthologies that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about Phantom and Avenger and the Vampire Anthology. And the Dark Delicacies anthology.
Right.
Are all of those comics, we didn't get to finish that conversation, or are some of those prose?
Dark Delicacies was a comic. The Avenger, the Vampire, the Phantom are all prose.
Oh, okay.
They're short story collections, along with a Green Hornet one that's coming up soon that I got to write for as well.
So you haven't even written that story yet?
No, it's written and turned in. It's just waiting to be. It's
okay.
On the publishing schedule. I'm not sure when Moonstone will be putting those out, but Moonstone does these great collections of the old pulp type characters, and you know, I try to worm my way in on as many of them as possible.
Well, having done so many comics up to this point, what was it like, were you seeing the story in your head and just, writing it down as prose, or how did that process work in your brain?
Prose takes me longer to write than comics because, I can take 30 seconds and describe what I need in a panel. I don't have to get it, it doesn't have to be flowery, it doesn't have to be interesting, it just has to be factual, this panel, the Green Hornet has turned and fired his gun. Well, that's very boring in prose, so you got to take more time. But that said, I've gotten enough of them through me now. Besides those, I've also got my character Lucius Fogg I've been working with. And, it's a different writing discipline, but it's a lot of fun to be in complete control where I'm not, when I'm done with a page, it's done. Not like with comic writing, you finish a page, then it goes to the penciler, then it goes to the inker. And, as a prose writer, anything you want on that page, you better write the words to describe it.
Well, it does require, I think, a lot more wordsmithing.
Yes.
To be able to effectively convey the thoughts to the reader. Do you find that it comes easy to you now that you've done several?
It depends. For some reason, the Lucius Fogg ones are really easy to write, but then I'm writing those first person.
Okay.
The other ones, I write third person, and normally it comes easily, but every once in a while it's like, wow, I need a different way to describe the Phantom right now. I've used the ghost that walks three times on this page. I've used all the different variations. You just want to say his name differently. I really screwed myself up with the Phantom story because when I do a prose piece like that, and it's a pulp character or a character that's been around a long time, I look at the character and I try to find something about them, something about that makes them unique. And with the Phantom, it's the history, the lineage of the Phantom
mm-hmm.
that I wanted to focus on. So I came up with a storyline where a assassin was sent to kill the Phantom, but he's the type that wants to learn all about his prey before he kills him. And since this guy couldn't track down the Phantom, what he did was he became the Phantom, and he got himself the costume, and he went, started going out and helping people. So by the time the regular, Kit Walker actually returns to Bengali, this guy has been going around for months as the Phantom, and the two of them head off and fight each other. So while I'm doing these fight scenes, I'm really writing about two Phantoms. So every way to describe them is the exact same.
Well, that had to be tough.
Yeah, it got very interesting after a while.
Well, just for our listeners, the live portion of the show is about to come to a close here shortly. Dan and I are going to keep talking here, and feel free to pick up the podcast. It's usually available about an hour after the show's over because Dan is going to share with us some breaking news, and you'll only be able to hear that if you download the show and listen to it after it's posted. So hopefully that will tempt you all to go pick that up. In the meantime, before we get to that breaking news, I know that you've done a lot of work with Xenoscope between the 1001 Arabian Nights Adventures of Sinbad series and the Grimm Fairy Tales.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, I noticed I subscribe to the Publisher Weekly comic newsletter, and they printed a story about some new comics and graphic novels coming out from Xenoscope that they've actually contracted with the Discovery Channel and Animal Planet to do some work based on some of their series. And I was wondering if, number one, if you were aware of that, and number two, if that's something that interests you or that they might contact you about becoming involved in.
I was not aware of that, and I'm now making a note to myself to call Ralph and Joe and see what's going on with that. And, yeah, actually, depending on which shows they are, I think they'd be a lot of fun to work on.
Yeah. I know the one is talking about prehistoric predators for the Discovery Channel, and one it mentions the one for Animal Planet. It will be about their shark series. So apparently they're doing a lot of...
I was hoping they'd do dirty jobs.
Oh, well, perhaps. That might be something to pitch to them. But now, they also talk, you know, this story gives a bit of a history of Zenoscope and their... the genres that they're marketing to, and it talks about the Grimm Fairy Tales and about the Beyond Wonderland series and the Sinbad series. What's it like working on those?
They're different to work on. Sinbad, I come in and it's my baby to play with. You know, Ralph and Joe had an idea of what they wanted to do with Sinbad, but from the point of they wanted a very modernish style Sinbad, they didn't want. When we approached Sinbad, I went back and looked at the original 1001 Arabian Nights series book and read. And if you read the actual Seven Voyages of Sinbad, what you learn first is he is the world's worst sailor. He goes out seven times and gets shipwrecked seven times. Now, I realize that those would be interesting stories to tell, but they're not the Sinbad people really wanted. It wasn't the Sinbad that Joe and Ralph really want. I keep saying Joe and Ralph. I should say Joe Brucia and Ralph Tedesco. They run and own Zenoscope.
Mm-hmm.
So when talking to them about the Sinbad series, what I wanted to do was approach it kind of like the X-Men. I wanted to put a crew together for Sinbad that all had very unique characteristics, had very unique personalities as well. And they were all for that. So where they came to me and said, we really want a Sinbad like this, I went, well, great. Then I want to put these kind of people around him, and I want to tell the story, you know, what the story of him being wanted for murder in Baghdad. That way, you know, one of the most important things to Sinbad is where he's from. And you take that away from him, then he's got motivation. And that was my approach to doing Sinbad. And they've kind of let me run with that.
Well, I had a chance to pick up one of the trades of that. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, X-Men stylings, with the crew of people, it does seem like it's almost a superhero-ish kind of a group.
Well, and I try to throw in a couple nods to Chris Claremont. You know, there's one moment where two of the characters, there's, you know, a fastball special type,
uh-huh,
where he's actually throwing the guy. Or issue 8 is, I mean, growing up, I used to pick up the X-Men all the time, and there'd always be that, you know, the one comic that was nothing about a bar fight. You know, Wolverine would go to a bar, and suddenly the Juggernaut's there, and they would just have this brawl. And I thought that would be a lot of fun. So issue 8 of Sinbad, which starts the second story arc, is just a bar fight.
And then what about, you said that it's totally different working with that and with Grimm Fairy Tales.
Yeah, with Grimm Fairy Tales, Joe and Ralph have an overall idea of what they're doing with the story. You know, I mean, yes, they're independent issues, but there's a backstory. And what they do is they come up and they say, well, you know, we want a story for Three Blind Mice. That was the first one I did. And, you know, I'm looking at these going, let me get this straight. So you get Cinderella, you get all these hot, you know, the stories with these hot women in it that you got on the covers, and I get the Three Blind Mice. But, so they kind of gave me an idea of what they wanted, and from that I sat down and plotted out a story that I pitched to them. So with Sinbad, I'm a little more free, and, you know, they look over what I do and kind of, you know, give advice or, you know, notes. But with the Grimm Fairy Tales, they're much more hands-on.
Okay. Now, I know that, you know, the whole premise of that is the, you know, the open source kind of you know, fairy tales that everybody knows and loves, but putting new spins on them. How were you able to do the crossover with the Arabian Nights?
Well, what we did was Joe wrote the Sinbad issue, and I wrote the Grim Fairy Tale side of it. And what he did was he took a fairy tale, or he basically wanted to tell the Cat's Paw.
Okay.
But using the characters from Sinbad. And what I wanted to do was tell, you know, when I went to the Grim Fairy Tale side, I went through and I looked for the absolute most obscure fairy tale I could find. And it's one that I've yet to find anybody who's ever heard of. It's called The Three Snake Leaves.
Hmm.
And what I was able to do was actually tell the origin of one of the characters in Sinbad named Wilhelm by using that fairy tale.
Interesting.
Yeah, so, and then what each of the Grimm Fairy Tales issues does is it shows you a modern version of the fairy tale and the original version, so you see how they, you know, how they go together.
Oh, well, that's cool. So now are you still ongoing with both of those series?
With Sinbad, I am. We are finishing it. We had a little lay, a little delay on the issues, but issue 11 is finishing up at the colorist right now. The letterer is already working on it, and the new artist on it, a gentleman named Brent Peoples, is starting on number 12. He drew all of 11, and I am really, really impressed with his work. We've had a lot of artist issues on the series, and mostly not the fault of the artist or anybody else, just bad timing. But we did the first three issues of the second story arc with Eduardo Ferragato, who just gorgeous work, but he wasn't available to do the last three of the story arc. So I got them to bring in Brent, and he's just doing some amazing work on the book. And I'm really, really happy with the team we've got on it right now.
But what about Grim Fairy Tales?
With Grim, it kind of rotates around the different writers. So every once in a while I'll get an email going, hey, Dan, you want to do this one? And
okay.
So, but they're getting closer to issue 50, and that's supposed to be a big reveal for them. So Joe and Ralph are kind of taking the reins back on it again. So,
a little secrecy there.
Yeah, but they've got a couple other projects that we're talking about. One I took to them, and one they brought to me, and we're going to see how those are going to move forward too. So I may be doing some more stuff with Zenoscope very soon.
Well, I also see that you got to be involved in the Wonderland annual, which I guess is kind of a spin-off or a secondary kind of the Grim Fairy Tales line.
Yeah, that's mainly written by Raven Gregory, and it's a very twisted, and if you ever meet Raven, you can see exactly where it came from. He's a very twisted individual. And they wanted to do an annual, but they wanted to do it. There's a point where there's a suicide in this house, and it involves Wonderland, and this house is a portal to Wonderland. You know, the mirror is in the basement of this house. And what they wanted to do was tell just like a classic haunted house story, but they wanted it, you know, what would happen to the next family that moved in after Alice and her family moved out.
Cool.
And I pitched them the idea. I said, okay, well, what I want to do is something, you know, if I'm going to do it, I don't want to do just another a haunted house story. I want to do it a little different. I wanted to add a little bit more to it. So what I did was I said, well, do you remember the old Travolta movie, The Boy in the Bubble?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I said, well, what if the family that moves into that house is moving in because they needed a bigger room to turn it into a clean room for their son who has to stay in this room?
Interesting take on it.
Yeah, and then it's his artwork. He's an art, he draws, but he's, you know, he's young. He's 10, 11 years old. So it's not like gorgeous artwork. It's 10, 11-year-old artwork. and it's his artwork that starts coming to life.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so it's just an odd, different take. I did have a friend of mine call me up afterwards, and there's a particular way I kill somebody in the story that has given this poor girl nightmares now.
Aw. So, you know, you've got the Sinbad series, you've got the new Shadowhawk series that you're working on now.
Right.
You said you've got the Green Hornet anthology that's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
What else can we look for that might be on the bookstore shelves?
The only thing I can officially talk about now would be, and it's not on the bookshelves, it's going to be the new thing I'm doing with Lucius Fogg.
Okay, that's the character that you came up with.
Right.
And tell us about that.
Lucius Fogg, the best way to describe him is if you crossed Doctor Strange with Nero Wolfe. You know, he's a detective back in the 30s that specializes in the occult, and the case is too bizarre for the cops to handle. And he's got some odd little quirks about him. And the story is actually told from his investigator/legman point of view, a guy named Jimmy Doyle. And what I did was I introduced the character last year at Comic-Con. I did a novella called Three Little Ladies All in the Morgue and did a very limited print run on it. Sold them at Comic-Con and got some really good positive reviews from it, not only from the people buying it, but you know, I showed it around to some other writers and editors and stuff, and was told that, you know, this is definitely a character that has some legs that you can, you know, do more stories with. So I decided to start working on a full-length novel, and which I'm working on now. But at the same time, I had a second story idea that would work for another novella, but I wanted to use it in a way to start promoting the character. So what I've done is I've created a Twitter account called for Lucius Fogg. So it's just twitter.com/Lucius Fogg as one word, LuciusFogg.
Okay.
And what I'm going to do is, starting on July 1st, I'm going to write the second novella on Twitter exclusively. I'm going to just, you know, open up the Twitter account and do it in 140 character segments just write the entire novella on Twitter so people can follow along for free. And, you know, some days I'll do 500 to 1,000 words. Other days I'll do short little parts. But you can follow along for free. And the title of that novella is going to be The Werewolves of Paddington Court.
Werewolves of Paddington Court.
Yes.
Available only on Twitter.
Yes.
Now, you said, we talked before the show, you're doing this in conjunction with another project, is that correct?
Well, yeah, I'm working on a novel version of Lucius Fogg as well.
Okay, so this will keep, you know, get people acclimated to the character.
Right.
And then, now, will you also make an announcement there, or is that, you know, when the book deck actually does come out, or is that just strictly for the story?
Well, once the story is complete, then I'll use that to promote anything else that comes along with Lucius Fogg.
Okay. But now you're also on Twitter as Ben Wickline.
Yes.
Okay. And where else can people find you online?
I'm on Facebook as Dan Wickline. I have my own webpage at danwickline.com. So you can see a trend here.
Now, I actually have your webpage up here. I know that you know, you also have a, I guess it's somewhere between budding and booming, photography work that you do.
Yeah.
How did you get into that?
Believe it or not, it has to do with comics and back when I was publishing. One of the people in the little group that I had put together was a female writer named Michelle, who was basing her character off herself, and her artist had moved to Arizona and needed photo reference of her to draw from. and she asked me if I would take pictures of her. I said, okay. I really hadn't done that much with photography. I think I took like half of photography class in high school, and took shots of her. And while we were shooting, she said, you know, I always wanted to do bathing suit shots, so I took some bathing suit shots of her, and that just led me to shooting with like every female friend I had. Somewhere along the lines, I became a glamour/artistic photographer.
So, I mean, it started as a favor to a friend.
Yeah.
And has really picked up. And yeah. You've had gallery shows and everything, haven't you?
Yeah, I've done a couple gallery shows, the most recent being one back on the 2nd of May. I did one called 40 for 40, which was also right around my 40th birthday. And what it was 40 of, you know, my favorite 40 prints from, you know, the 15 years of photography that I've been shooting.
Cool. And do you have anything coming up with photography in the near future?
Well, there's a book available of my work called Private Skin. You can still get it on Amazon.
Cool.
That came out in about 2005, so it's older work, but some good stuff in it still. And what I'm going to start doing is I'm going to start offering prints of some of my newer work on a very limited basis, maybe 20 to 25 per month, and just pick a new print each month. And that'll be, you'll be able to find those on my webpage.
Cool. Now, you know, aside from writing and photography, you have a couple extracurricular activities. I know that you and I met through World of Warcraft.
Right.
Which you said before the show that your characters had lacked attention. I'm assuming that aside from the writing and the photography, your other extracurricular activity has something to do with that. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I recently, about 2 years ago, I started playing bass guitar, and that has grown to the point where I am now in a brand new band called Murder Most Foul.
Which is an awesome name.
Oh, thank you. And it's a metal band. We're it's along with myself, a gentleman named Don Pena is the lead guitarist, and Don was the guitarist for Man the Destroyer, which ironically Don and his band Man the Destroyer make a guest appearance in Shadowhawk number 2.
I saw that, and yeah. I thought, I've heard of that. Heard of that band before.
Yeah. Well, they're based up in Toronto, and Don lives in L.A., and he kept flying up there and for concerts and stuff. And finally, this is ridiculous. So he's, Man the Destroyer is continuing on, and Don has is going to focus down here on a new band and asked me to be his bassist, which is ironic since he's also the gentleman who taught me how to play bass. So he's
cool.
My instructor. And we're working right now. We're finding ourselves our lead singer, but we've got about three original songs that we're ready to go with, and we're looking to start doing shows in August.
Awesome. So it does sound like you've got a lot on your plate. How are you able to balance all of your the projects and things that you're involved in? Do you set aside time and say, okay, Wednesday nights from 6 to 8 is my, writing night, or do you schedule, time for other things that way?
Well, I gave up sleep and sanity first. That was
there you go. Okay. All right.
I am blessed to be in a position where those are also my job, so I don't have a full-time job I have to worry about, and that allows me to spend my days doing that. I've always written very fast, so,
But, I mean, you still have, there are deadlines and things that you have to meet, though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the band takes up, probably about 10, 12 hours a week right now. Writing takes up probably about 20 to 25 hours a week.
That's not bad for your main job to,
no,
to be.
No. And then photography takes up probably about 5 or 6 hours a week, depending if I'm shooting that week or not. But, you know, editing photos and stuff like that takes up a good amount of time.
I guess that's not too bad. All in all, it adds up to just a little bit over 40.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's the equivalent of a day job, but a lot more fun, I think.
Definitely. I mean, I wish I had that kind of a job.
Well, if anybody had asked me how to get to where I am now, I can't tell them because it was completely by accident.
Well, now you said you started writing, you know, out of high school and that just kind of flourished. Did you ever have the traditional 9-to-5 kind of a job?
Oh yeah. I went to college and became a computer programmer and spent 13 years doing that. For a while, I was working a job where I was tech support for 60 companies, all having my pager number.
Oh, so wow.
I was on call 24/7 for about 5 years. So I did that.
But that was a long 5 years.
Yes, it was. I could literally be in sleep and, you know, in bed at 1 in the morning, at 2 in the morning, get a phone call, and at 5 in the morning be on a plane to Chicago.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet you were glad to get out of that.
Very much so.
So what, I mean, computer programming, that takes a lot to get into. I'm just thinking with the amount of stuff that you have to learn and dedicate to actually getting into that, you know, did it feel like you were giving up a whole bunch of your life that you had invested there, or were you, you know, glad to be rid of it?
Mainly I was glad to be rid of it. I spent most of those years as kind of a firefighter type programmer where there would be days that I had absolutely nothing to do and I would sit around and I'd write.
Oh.
Where on other days, I'd have nothing but crisis to deal with. And, you know, I think on one of the job sites I worked 126 hours in 1 week trying to get everything up and running.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was kind of a feast or famine type job, which allowed me the down times to focus on the other things I wanted to do. So when it came time to, you know, put that aside, it was a pretty easy move.
Well, you know, but also, I mean, you just said that gave you the opportunity to invest some time or to develop those things that you're using now that you love to do.
Yeah.
You know, because they say if you find a job doing what you love to do, you'll never work another day of your life.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I've got a couple scripts out there. I won't say which ones or which companies, but there's one or two stories out there I've written that were written completely on a company computer. And you know, I got my hourly rate for doing that.
Well, you know, if there's nothing in your job queue, what can you do, huh?
Exactly.
Well, Dan, I appreciate you spending the time with us tonight. For everybody who's listening, again, you can find Dan at danwickline.com. He's also on Twitter and Facebook. I've appreciated being able to get behind the mask with you tonight, Dan.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity. It was fun.
Thanks for your time. Maybe in a few months we'll get you back on the show and see how your novella's going.
Anytime.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks, and have a good night.
Take care.
This show brought to you by Circle of Seven Productions, www.cosproductions.com. Please be sure to subscribe, and welcome to our circle.